Today at Reader's Corner, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tracy Kidder talking about his latest book, Strength in What Remains.
Some of these places he hadn't visited since his escape, and it was as though the memories were waiting there for him, you know, almost like some kind of pathogens. What's most extraordinary about this story to me is that after all of this, he should go back to this country shattered by war to try to do his part in rebuilding a country through medicine and public health. People think of New York City as being a very cold and nasty place, and I suppose it is in some ways, but it's probably the best place a refugee to come. I mean, think about it. There's 12 million people in New York City. You're bound to run into some nice ones.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In 1994, a young medical student from the Central African nation of Burundi was pitched into the heart of a horrific genocide that killed hundreds of thousands of people and devastated two countries. Finding his way to New York City, he arrived with the clothes on his back, $200 in his pocket, and no English skills. He lived homeless in Central Park before being adopted by an extraordinary couple. In time, he found his way to Columbia University and eventually back to Burundi, where he realized his long-held dream of establishing a health clinic in his native village. This truly remarkable story is told by Tracy Kidder in his book Strength in What Remains. Now out in paperback, the book is an inspiring narrative of one man's flight from the nightmare of genocide to a new beginning full of opportunity and healing. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mr. Kidder. In 1981, he won the Pulitzer Prize for the nonfiction narrative The Soul of a New Machine. Mr. Kidder also has been lauded for Mountains Beyond Mountains, his biography of Paul Farmer, creator of Partners in Health. That book was a campus read selection at Boise State back in 2006, and I had the honor of interviewing Mr. Kidder about Mountains Beyond Mountains on this program. Mr. Kidder's latest book is Good Prose, The Art of Nonfiction, published in January of 2013. He joined us by phone for this interview. Tracy Kidder, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Great to talk to you again.
Your title of this book was taken from a Wordsworth poem. I'll read just the four lines. Though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, of glory in the flower, we will not grieve, rather not find, strength in what remains behind. Strength in what remains behind, obviously, you dropped behind. Tell us how that fits, the title of a book about this gentleman, Deo
right.
Gratias.
Well, can I just say one thing, Bob, just from your opening? It's sort of important. What happened in Burundi wasn't a genocide. It was an ethnic civil war. What happened in Rwanda, which Deo got
That's right.
up into, was
yeah.
a genocide. Anyway, that may seem like splitting hairs, but I think it's rather important.
Sure.
Well, I was kind of desperate for a title, and I had remembered that poem from studying the English Romantic poets in college, and it just seemed to fit. You know, there is, of course, a sadness in any life that's been torn in two, and there's a lot that's lost, of course. But this guy, if anybody on earth is strong, he is strong. It seemed to fit, you know, and the lines around it seem to fit, too. It goes on, we will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind in the primal sympathy, which having been must ever be, in the soothing thoughts that spring out of human suffering, in the faith that looks through death, in years that bring the philosophic mind. And I don't know, this is a guy who, when he did get to Columbia, a penniless immigrant, you'd expect to study something marketable like computer science. And it is true that he majored in biochemistry because he was determined to continue his medical studies. But he also majored in philosophy, and, you know, probably the least marketable thing on earth. I asked him why, and he said, I wanted to understand what had happened to me. And, of course, like anyone who studies philosophy, as he put it, he didn't get too many answers, but a lot more questions.
Right. Well, your comment about what a strong man he is reminds me of the great man debate. Does history make the man, or does the man make history? In Deo's case, I know there's no perfect answer for this, but it will yep. allow you, if nothing else, to expand on Deo. But if you placed 100 Burundis in the same circumstance, aided and abetted by some extraordinary people who we're going to talk about in a moment, How many of them would have reacted in the same way? How many of them would have survived the way he did? How many of them would have found their way to Columbia as an undergrad, to Dartmouth Medical School, back to Burundi to establish a health clinic? I'm just so curious about this individual and to what extent he was, in a sense, blessed by some fortunate incidents in his life, but to what extent this is about the inner strength of a man who overcame so much.
As you said, there's no perfect answer for that,
right.
And not in general or even in particular. It's true that he was lucky, and it's true that he was resourceful, and it's also true that he was resilient and tough. What I do remember, one day we were standing outside this memorial site in Rwanda where a horrific massacre had taken place, and where he almost got trapped but didn't. And he was just sort of showing me, you know, gesturing toward the landscape of how he had going around this place and headed back, you know, on foot. He, you know, 6 months escape on foot. And I said, "God, oh boy, Dale, you are one tough guy. I would have quit." And he said, "Oh, if you knew how many times I almost quit." And so, I mean, we're not talking about Superman here, but we are talking about someone very determined. You know, it's funny. I was just talking to someone about the whole issue of whether people are more resilient because they have grown up in tough circumstances, or are they less? It's such a tough question because, on the one hand, poverty weakens people in many ways, but Deo's family wasn't poor by the local standards. By our standards, they certainly were. No shoes until high school, but the fact that he even had a chance to go to high school there suggests that he wasn't terribly poor. But if you're healthy and so on, but you are used to making 16-hour treks through the mountains of that mountainous country, carrying food and things like that from a very early age, well, I'm not sure that doesn't prepare you in a way that I certainly have not been prepared. One of the things that's interesting to me about Deo, if you compared his story to that of, say, Paul Farmer, when we meet Deo anyway, he's much more, even though he comes from a culture we, you know, from a country most of us never even heard of, and a very different culture from ours, he's a little bit more like most of us. That is, you know, Paul Farmer is already, when we meet him in my book anyway, a very accomplished person. Deo is still a student. And I think it's easier for a reader, was for me, to ask the question, how would I have done in his shoes? The answer for me is pretty clear to me anyway. I wouldn't have survived. I simply wouldn't have survived. I grew up too soft. I think maybe that's a simplistic answer, and I'm kind of dodging your question.
Well, I did notice, though, in reading your book, I thought a lot about the fact that I interview authors and writers every week on this show, and there have been a few who have ventured into some pretty strange territory. I did one not long ago about South America, the Lost City of Z, and that was a pretty scary prospect for the author. David Grant, I believe, is his name. But as I'm reading you going back with Deo to some pretty interesting territory, interesting is hardly the word for it, dangerous would be far better. Did you, from the beginning of this book, know that you would go into this uncharted land? I mean, uncharted for you anyway. Maybe Deo knew his way around. But there were a few moments in your telling this story that I kind of wondered, boy, you had to stop and think, well, what have I gotten myself into here?
That may be my fault. I don't think, in fact, as I reflect on this, that I was ever in any physical danger. Burundi had emerged by the time I went there from its civil war. There was peace. It was and still is a fragile peace, but what was scary to me, or disconcerting, it might be a better word, was the psychological, not the sort of physical facts. This is really a book about one person, and part of my job is to try to, and you can never do this wholly, but to try to figure out what's it like to be him. And it was as though when we went back over this landscape, this is something I thought I should do from the very start, to go back and actually visit the stations of his life. And some of those places he hadn't visited since his escape. And it was as though the memories were waiting there for him, almost like some kind of pathogens. And so he was not, in some cases, and particularly in one, in a very comfortable frame of mind. In fact, the one that I guess I really focus on, I felt as though I was inside one of his nightmares, looking at the source of his nightmare. at the hospital, the fragment of a hospital where his long escape had begun and where he was almost killed. And it was upsetting to me, but nowhere near as hard to bear as it was for him. I would hate to exaggerate the danger that I was in, because I really don't think I was in any real physical danger. I just think it was psychologically pretty upsetting, but again, much more for him than for me. And I'm not sure now. I think things have turned out all right, but I'm not sure I would do this book again, given the burden that it put on him. You know, I don't think either of us really foresaw that. How hard it would be for him.
You're listening to Tracy Kidder. He is the author of Strength in What Remains. One of the burdens, apparently, is the fact that he is a bit publicity shy, and as I understand it, that's one of the reasons why there's no photos in this book. I have to admit that I got into the first chapter, and I went immediately to the middle of the book to find a picture of Deo, and I couldn't. He apparently didn't go for that.
You know, as a rule, Bob, I don't put photographs in these books. They are, I hope, factually accurate. But I've always felt that photographs were unfair competition for a writer. You know, by the way, in the first edition, a lot of names were changed, and some still are, but I've changed back to the real one, the name of the place where the clinic, and indeed it's more than a clinic now, is situated. It's not Sangaza, but Kagutu. Of course, it is Sangaza in that first edition, but he gave me permission to do that. So I think that some of his fears about all of this have abated, and I didn't blame him for those, and I wanted to honor those. What's most extraordinary about this story to me, talk about strength, is that after all of this, he should go back to this country, you know, shattered by war, and as you say, to try to fulfill a childhood dream, but more than that, to try to do his part in rebuilding a country through medicine and public health. I mean, that clinic, it's called Village Health Works. And if any of your listeners want to find out more about it, they have a wonderful website, villagehealthworks.org. I found that place so moving. Just to give you an example, I think it's in my book, but, you know, at one point after the clinic had opened, and by the way, you know, it's free to all those who can't pay the medical care, and people have been coming from all over the place to avail themselves of its services. Dale told me about one guy who came. I wasn't there, but who wasn't sick, and Deo asked him, "Oh, why did you come?" And he said, "To see America," which I thought was pretty potent. This little place, which is getting bigger all the time, has a real possibility of being an instrument of peace, it seems to me. And perhaps it will spread in that country, which has been so deprived of those kinds of things that I, for one, believe are really human rights, primary human rights, maybe the most elemental, which is the right to decent public health and to medicine.
Well, to your point about his decision to go back to his native land and contribute, he had his American citizenship. This is a guy who could just stay in New York City or Dartmouth, wherever he wanted to, and never look back.
And lead a, you know, an exemplary life, as many refugees have. He basically, I mean, he interrupted his medical training again to do this, and he's resumed it elsewhere.
Where is he?
I don't think I'm at liberty to say.
Oh, okay.
It's a fine place, and I would have to have his permission, you know.
But the good news is he's back in medical school.
Yeah.
I see.
My editor, Richard Todd, likes to tell a story about how when he was a kid, this goes to the question of writing nonfiction about real people. Back in the days when he was a kid, your grandpa could take you to a bar and sit you on a stool next to him and nobody minded, while your grandpa had a snort, as they put it.
Right.
In this one bar where his grandfather liked to do this, there was a head of a deer on the wall, and he remarked on this to his grandfather. His grandfather said, "Yeah, it's a really sad story. The deer came running in the back of this place and got stuck in the wall." He said, "And sometime I'll take you around to the back and show you the other end." Well, you know, this is an analogy for my friend and editor, Richard Todd, that to express the fact about nonfiction. You know, when you're writing a novel, well, the people in that novel essentially come to an end when the book ends. But that doesn't happen with nonfiction. The hind end of the deer is there, and actually it probably is the front end, because their lives go on. And I think at the end of this book, I don't feel I have the permission to sort of talk about his life subsequently unless he gives it to me, you know?
Sure. I understand. Tracy, I know people have written historical tomes on the Tutsis and the Hutus, the ethnic conflict in Rwanda and in Burundi. Could you sum up for us just where Deo Gratias comes from, what happens, the nature of this conflict. And what struck me is so absurd is that in the end, at least in 2011, it doesn't appear as though there's even much basis left for this distinction between these two so-called ethnic groups, Hutus and Tutsis.
Yeah, I should preface my answer by saying that this is still a very vexed subject, and I should also say that I don't fully understand it. It is also very different, or significantly different, in Rwanda historically than in Burundi. And let me just speak about Burundi. The distinction between these two groups was, you know, a difference that had arisen within a civilization, the civilization of East Africa. And then the colonials came, first the Germans, then the Belgians. And as I understand it, what the Belgians did, the Belgian colonials, was they elevated one group above another for their own purposes, of course, so that they wouldn't have to spend a lot of administrative costs or have a lot of their own people there. And that group happened to be this group called the Tutsis. But they did more than that. They did this also in Rwanda. They made this distinction into something it had never been and never will be, which was a racial distinction. And they used a racist myth that had arisen in Europe and really was a sort of precursor to the Holocaust, to the Jewish Holocaust, I think, as I understand it anyway. You know, meanwhile, the vast majority of Tutsis were not, you know, benefiting enormously. So there was one class that was elevated above the other and in many cases didn't behave all that well, as you might expect. So this distinction was fueled by colonialism. And when colonialism ended in Burundi, a tragic thing happened. Again, as I understand it, the distinction was sort of muted there, and it was a much more complicated society than Rwanda. And they had a prince named Rwagasore, who was tremendously popular with everyone. He was not a Tutsi or a Hutu, he was a Ganwa. And you don't want to hear all of this, but then he was assassinated. And many people think he was assassinated with the help of the Belgians because he was pushing for immediate independence. And this distinction, which is really a fake distinction in many ways, because there was a lot of intermarriage, of course, and so on. I mean, I know Tutsis from Burundi who, by the Belgian standards, aren't tall enough to have been Tutsis. The Belgians came up with all these physical descriptions. It's just insane. In any case, it then got sort of used for the advantage of a few and politicized, and eventually it led to war. And it's much more complicated than all of that because relations between Rwanda and Burundi were always vexed, with the problems in one country fueling the problems in the other, and on and on. It's tremendously complicated. And one reason that it's very hard to speak with great certainty about all of this is that we don't have very good historical records, pre-colonial records. And the other reason is that it is still a politicized issue. But to people like Deo, and I think to a lot of people in places like Burundi, it's just not an issue. People don't want to talk about it anymore, or if they ever did.
Right. You're listening to Tracy Kidder. He is the author of Strength in What Remains. So Deo spends 6 months on the run once the killing started. How did he manage to escape the initial onslaught?
Well, he was working in the hospital sort of as an intern, you know, a resident. It wasn't quite the same system we have. And when it started, he ran into his room. He forgot to close his door, hid under his bed. The man who would have killed him, finding the room empty, not looking under the bed, but the door open, assumed that he'd already run away, so they didn't search. And once the massacre had been completed and the place had grown silent, he ran out of the hospital and into the countryside. And he was very good at finding his way through countryside because he had spent his childhood doing that, humping bags of cassava over mountains. He escaped from there, but unfortunately for him, he went north and went into Rwanda thinking he'd be safe there. But he was never safe there. He ended up in refugee camps near the border of Rwanda and Burundi. And these were largely, were at the time being run by people who were going to participate in the genocide of Tutsis in Rwanda. And so it was very scary, and he had to be very careful, you know, for many months. And then when the genocide erupted, he pretty much set off on his own to try to get back to Burundi.
How does he ever get on a plane to the United States?
Well, that's just really wild. He had a friend at medical school who was both Burundian and also French, and therefore, you know, of a somewhat elevated caste. And his friend got him a ticket. I think it was on Aeroflot, and also helped him get a visa. And his friend was his friend who decided that the U.S. is where he should go. I don't know why exactly. So he did. He came. The visa was obtained under false pretenses. I mean, he was traumatized, terrified, and he was forgiven for that. Ultimately, that was all straightened out in New York subsequently. But he got on that plane and came to this strange land, as you said, without English.
And lives homeless in New York. He's in Central Park. And then there's these interventions, which I guess I would refer to as random acts of kindness.
I think that's about right.
You know, incredible people. I wonder if you could just tell us briefly about Sharon and about this couple that literally take the guy in.
Well, it really started with a baggage handler at JFK Airport.
That's right, yeah.
Who helped him out, but, you know, took him home. But this guy was just trying to earn money to take back home to Africa, to Senegal. And it was really a crack house in Harlem. Once that guy left, Dale sort of lost his protection, and he found that he preferred Central Park. Of course, it was summertime, and I don't think he understood what winter meant. But before that happened, you know, one day, sort of sick and near despair, he was delivering groceries. That was how he made a little pittance and was able to eat. He was delivering groceries to an uptown Catholic, little small, beautiful little Catholic church, and he met this ex-contemplative nun, Sharon McKenna, and you know, I'm not sure. I'm not a terribly religious person. I hope I'm respectful. But if there's a holy person, there is such a thing as a holy person. She's one of them. She spoke a little bit of French, and she got very interested in Dale, and she decided that he needed a home. He needed a family. And she set out to find him one. And this woman is indefatigable. She just doesn't give up. So, in fact, she drove Dale slightly crazy in this search for a family. At a certain point, he thought she wanted this more than he did. And anyway, she did find him one. A childless couple, an artist and a sociologist. Neither young nor rich, but big-hearted and brave, obviously. And they essentially adopted him. And they certainly don't regret it. You know, again, you wonder, would I have done that? But they would tell you now that it was the best thing they ever did. So it's, you know, I was thinking about this. People think of New York City as being a very cold and nasty place, and I suppose it is in some ways, but it's probably the best place for a refugee to come, you know, if a refugee doesn't have any family or contacts or English or money. I mean, think about it. There's 12 million people in New York City. You're bound to run into some nice ones, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting that we're talking about Burundis. Boise is a city that has been a destination for refugees. The federal government has identified Boise as a place for a number of different refugee groups to come, including Burundis.
I'm sorry, I had no idea.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that because this is my own take on it. Maybe some of our listeners will have a different take, but we seldom see Burundis or any other refugee group around the city, in at least in most of what I do. And I do get out a little bit. Admittedly, I'm on the campus more than most. But it does beg the question, well, could it be that if a guy like Deo Gratias came to Boise, he might stand less of a chance meeting up with folks like he did in New York City, given the interesting places there are for refugees to hang out? Yeah. In a very large city such as New York.
That might well be. Nothing against Boise, though. It's just that New York sometimes strikes me as the capital of the world, you know?
Yeah.
Which about every language on earth is spoken. And, you know, a city always in great flux. You know, the standard joke about New York is a visitor comes and says, this will be a really nice city when you finish it. You know?
Yeah.
But that may be the case. It's certainly a tremendously cosmopolitan place in many ways, and And again, you know, the odds are you're going to run into some really nice people there.
Right.
I suppose there are risks. You know, I do think, I'm quite sure that many, many refugees are not as well-schooled as Deo was. I mean, most Burundians, the vast majority, never had a chance to go to school. You know, and these will typically, I would think, be farming people, resourceful people, but folks without a lot of education. So they start with a handicap. But yeah, that could be. But I don't know Boise well. I've only been there the one time when I talked with you, so I can't really say, you know,
right,
for sure.
Right. There's another interesting coincidence in that the last time you were in Boise and you did talk to me, you were here to talk about Mountains Beyond Mountains, which is the
yeah.
story of Paul Farmer. And as it turns out, Deo Gratias goes to work for Paul Farmer.
Exactly. In fact, I tell this story a little elliptically in strength and what remains, but not because I was hiding anything, but just it seemed the right way to tell it. But the way I met Deo was in 2003, I'd gone to visit Paul Farmer. It was just about time I'd finished that book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, and he'd had a big operation on a knee, and it was a pretty serious operation. He was pretty much laid up, and he was living in an apartment at Harvard. I went to visit him, and there was this guy there. And as it happened, my wife came with me, and as it happened, Paul Farmer wanted to talk with me, and my wife ended up speaking to Deo, and then on the way home, she told me what she remembered of the story that he'd told her. And I remember thinking, wow, that's quite a story. But, you know, I kind of filed it away for 3 years, and then was, well, I did another book, and you know, it was there, and I remember, then I didn't know what to do after I finished that other book, which is the most difficult part of my life, trying to figure out what to do next, and I tend to share my difficulty with my family, sorry to say. My wife finally said in something like consternation, why don't you go talk to that guy we met at Paul's? So I did, and eventually, you know, I thought this is a story I'd like to tell once he'd told it to me.
We all owe your wife one on that one because we've run out of time. But, Tracy,
sorry,
I've got to say that it's just a great read, and it's so inspirational. I want to remind our listeners again, I was on Village Health Works. Is that the name of it? I was on that website.
VillageHealthWorks.org.
There's a place where people can donate to help Deo do his work in Burundi. I just can't thank you enough for taking the time to be on the show and for writing the book. Again, it's called Strength in What Remains. Thanks so much, Tracy Kidder.
Bob, it's great to talk to you again.
Thank you for joining us today on Reader's Corner. I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Tracy Kidder. Next week, Christopher Steiner, author of Automate This, How Algorithms Came to Rule Our World. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.